listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In the eighth year of fighting with terrorists in Syria, we bring you today this very interesting interview of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, brought to us from Press TV's Damascus Bureau Chief, Hossan Murtada.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mr. President, there are many issues which we will talk about, but in the light of the victories you have achieved, the main focus remains the south of Syria. What's happening exactly, or what is the nature of what is happening in the south of Syria?
To put it simply, after the liberation of Al-Ghouta, it was suggested that we should move south. We were faced with two options, as in the case in all other areas in Syria, reconciliation or liberation by force. At this point, the Russians suggested the possibility of giving reconciliation an opportunity, similar to what happened in other areas, in order to restore the situation that prevailed before 2011. In other words, for the Syrian army to be deployed in that area, which is an area of confrontation with the Zionist enemy. And of course, the terrorists should leave the area. This proposition suits us. Up till now, there are no concrete results for a simple reason, which is Israeli and American interference. For they put pressure on the terrorists in that area in order to prevent reaching any compromise or peaceful resolution. That is how the situation stands now.
So it's not been decided whether to move toward a military operation or toward reconciliation.
No. Contacts are still ongoing between the Russians, the Americans, and the Israelis, while nobody is communicating with the terrorists, because they are mere tools, and they implement what their masters decide ultimately. This is what happened. There was an opportunity to reach reconciliation, but the American and Israeli interference prevented that possibility.
Of course, this is the reality there. But on the other hand, there are those who talk about many things taking place in the South. Mr. President, is there a certain deal? What is the price? Is there really a price for concluding this deal in the South? Let me talk frankly about the issue of getting the Iranians to leave the southern region in return for Al-Tanf, for example. What did the Americans demand? Or let's say, what was the price the Americans asked to approve the reconciliation process in the South?
For the Americans, there is a general principle they follow in dealing with any problem in the world. The only price they ask for is absolute hegemony, regardless of the issue and the place. Of course, we shall never provide that price. Otherwise, we wouldn't have fought this war for years. We have been fighting for the independence of Syrian decision-making, for the Syrian homeland, and for the unity of Syrian territory. As for Iran in particular, let me be very clear. The Syrian-Iranian relationship is a strategic one, not subject to a deal in the south or in the north. This relationship, in terms of its implications and results on the ground, is linked to the present and future of the region. Consequently, it is not subject to the price tags of the international bazaar. Neither Syria nor Iran has floated this relationship on the international political bazaar for it to be subject to haggling. The proposition was made by the Israelis with the objective of provoking and embarrassing Iran. At the same time, this comes in line with the international propaganda campaign launched against Iran regarding the nuclear file. It is not a separate issue, for everything happening now is linked to Iran in order to create an international position against it. As for us in Syria, the decision concerning our land is an exclusively Syrian decision. We are fighting the same battle, and when we have a decision concerning Iran, we will talk about it with the Iranians and not with any other party.
Of course, we will talk about Iran and in more detail. But since we are talking about the Southern Front, let's explore it further. Practically in the same context, there is the MOC, which hasn't stopped its operation since the beginning of the war on Syria about 8 years ago. It is working and is still active and is directly linked to the Israelis. But we have noticed recently that it has been reactivated and there are more communications. Mr. President, does this mean that the Syrian state is practically moving toward a military decisive action in the south, regardless of the consequences, whether things reach a stalemate or not? Is there a decisive action in the cards for the Syrian leadership?
No. Mock has nothing to do with this decision. Mock has been linked to the presence and the role of the terrorists since the beginning of the war on Syria. That's why it existed, in order to lead them militarily. Consequently, the continued existence of this operations room means the continuation of the role given to these terrorists. They are equipped and prepared to carry out more terrorist acts. MOC is linked to the terrorists and not to the role of the Syrian state. Our role has nothing to do with it. Our decision has been clear from the beginning. We will liberate all Syrian lands. As to when to move south, north, east, or west, this is purely military issue. But regardless of MOC, we have moved towards the south and we are giving the political process a chance. If that doesn't succeed, we have no other option but to liberate it by force.
But there's a confrontation in the south, and the issue is not limited geographically to Syria in the larger political sense. There are the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, the Israelis, and Hezbollah. All these parties are there in the area. What does that mean? How are you going to deal with this?
You are talking about two axes. One supporting terrorism and represented by the US, Israel, and some flunkies in the region, including some Arab and non-Arab states, and an anti-terrorist axis. The first axis supports terrorism and seeks hegemony, while the second axis seeks independence. So, there can be only one result for this confrontation, the victory of one of these axes. At least, as far as the anti-terrorist axis is concerned, it will not give up the process of cleaning Syria and the region of terrorism, and will not give up on the unity of Syrian territory. As to the other axis, will it change as a result of the reality on the ground? Let's wait and see. But in terms of substance and convictions, it will not change. While in terms of the political practices dictated by reality and the facts on the ground, it might.
Will the Americans leave Al-Tanf?
The Americans say they are ready, but everyone knows that the Americans are historically professional liars in politics. So why should we believe them? Also, we have to wait and see.
Mr. President, what's happening now in Jordan? Is it linked to what's happening on the southern front in particular? That is it linked to what's being plotted in that region, in your view?
In fact, the only information we have is what we hear in the media. In any case, we wish Jordan stability, not chaos, because the latter will have a negative impact on us.
Since we are talking about the South, let's close this file. Mr. President, what would make the Israeli occupation agree to the return of the Syrian army to the borders? That is, a return to the situation which existed at the beginning of 2011, after 7 years of repeated Zionist attempts directly and indirectly to undermine the Syrian state, the regime in Syria, and stability in Syria. Why would it agree now to the return of the Syrian army to the borders and to the occupied Golan?
Certainly, neither conviction, morality, nor international law means anything to the Israelis. Since the beginning of the war, particularly when it started to have a clear military nature on the southern front in particular, the Israelis used to shell Syrian forces continuously and consequently provide direct support to the terrorists. Israeli artillery and aircraft are the terrorists' artillery and aircraft. That applies to Jabhat al-Nusra, of course. Nothing is going to change this Israeli approach. As far as we are concerned, Israel's approval had no role at all. Despite Israeli support to the terrorists, we have been doing our job, and the Syrian army is fighting its way towards the southern front and has liberated a number of areas within the limits of its capabilities. So, with or without its approval, the decision is a Syrian one, and this is a national duty we shall carry out.
So a return of the Syrian army is better than having resistance in the Golan, for instance?
For the Israelis?
Yes.
I think the two options are bad for the Israelis. Both of them are bad. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeatedly talked about Syria's relationship with the resistance and a Syrian role in the resistance. So, how would the Israelis choose between two bad things for them?
As you said, Mr. President, Israel has financed, supported, and more dangerously been capable of enlisting a large number of Syrians, some of whom were treated inside occupied Palestine. They talked about it. In the future, how would you deal with this large number of Israeli agents? Maybe some of them were deceived, and Israel might have exploited the financial and living conditions of some others. And some have chosen to side with the Israelis. How would you deal with them in the future?
This is true. We cannot put everyone in the same basket. There are different reasons for moving in this wrong direction. And these people have wronged the homeland and every Syrian citizen. Ultimately, they are the children of this homeland, and we all bear responsibility for this problem, not only those who have done wrong. When crime, for instance, becomes widespread in a certain country, the whole society bears responsibility for this crime, not only the security agencies or the criminals themselves. The first thing that should be done is to accommodate these people. Second, we need to address the root causes which led to this case of weak patriotism. The causes here are many and complicated, and the scope of this interview doesn't allow for all of them to be mentioned.
In the same context, while you're talking about restoring the Syrian air defense systems and confronting the Zionist occupation, statements have been made by leaders of the Israeli entity that they will strike at the depth of the Syrian territory. How would you deal with that situation, particularly that balance has been achieved recently, that is, balance between the Israeli aggressions and the Syrian responses?
Basically, we haven't stopped responding. First of all, we haven't stopped fighting terrorists. And at the same time, we haven't stopped responding to Israeli aggression within the capabilities available to us, militarily and technically. Moreover, the more these capabilities improve, the response will be better and higher. But in fact, the strongest response to Israel now is to strike the Israeli army existing in Syria, which consists practically of the terrorists.
Full formations.
Of course, for they are acting clearly and starkly in Israel's interest. The first acts they carried out were attacks against the air defense systems. What is the link between air defense systems and the terrorists acting as infantry on the ground? This was an Israeli order. It was an Israeli-American order because it is the same thing. So, they are Israel's army inside Syria. And the first strike against Israel, politically, militarily, and in every other area, is to strike Israel's terrorists inside Syria. Whether they belong to ISIS, Al-Nusra, or the other groups linked to the Israeli plan and strategy.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
This is what's happening. It's escalating, and we are responding. Ultimately, we are fighting the war within the capabilities available to us, and we are doing our best within these capabilities. A response does not need a political decision. I stress that responding or not responding is not a political decision. It is a national decision, and it was taken from day one. But implementing this decision depends on what we can do militarily and not politically.
In terms of capabilities, there's one issue in the media which we are always following. That is the S-300 Russian missiles. Russia says we will deliver these missiles and then says we will not deliver them, which means that the issue is not clear. What is happening exactly? Why is Russia hesitating, in your view, to deliver the S-300 missiles to Syria while some other countries have been seeking S-400? Does this mean they are ahead of us in this regard?
You know that military action and military considerations are part of political considerations. Consequently, a statement, even if it is of a military nature, carries at the same time political messages. So, why did the Russians say that they want to send or not send? This is a statement that the Russians should be asked about because it might be part of their political tactics. As to the military aspect of the statement, which concerns Syria, it's not our custom to talk about the weapon which we will be delivered or not delivered. The evidence was that the weapons used in response to the last two aggressions, the tripartite aggression, and after that the Israeli aggression, were not announced by Syria. We traditionally do not announce cases of technical military nature.
So even the nature of the response is not linked to the issue of the S-300 missiles?
No, the same applies. Even if the S-300 missiles will be provided or not provided, we will not say that they were delivered to Syria. A weapon is used when it must be used.
Is there a possibility that you've developed certain weapons?
This remains a possibility. In any case, the result is the same. Weapons shouldn't be talked about until they are used. Weapons announce themselves only when they are used.
Mr. President, let's return to the political aspect, since we are talking about the Southern Front. Regarding the general situation, in light of all that has been achieved in Syria today, the most prominent actor is the Tripartite Alliance, or what is being called the Tripartite Alliance. I mean Syria, Iran, and Russia. What is the nature of this alliance? Is it a temporary alliance in the sense that it is linked to fighting terrorism or certain developments on the Syrian perspective? Recently, we have started to see, or let's say some have focused on certain points in order to show a certain fracture in this alliance. What is your take on that, and what is the actual reality of this alliance?
If we talk first about the Syrian-Iranian part, for 40 years and in the different conditions that the Middle East region has gone through, this alliance remained solid. So, there is no reason to say that it is temporary or otherwise. The new element in the war on Syria is the Russian element, and that's why this tripartite alliance came into existence. Our relationship with Russia is now about 7 decades old. Despite the fluctuations and the fall of the Soviet Union, the rule of President Yeltsin, and the deterioration of these relations to a large degree for us, it has never reached the stage of reversing this relationship with Syria. Russia continued to deal with Syria as a friendly state. and we have imported everything from Russia, including weapons, during the different stages of the sanctions imposed on Syria. It is not in the nature of the Russians to build temporary or self-serving alliances or to sell out on relations in order to get deals done. The relationship is definitely a strategic one, but the political statements allowed for these speculations. These statements also aim at sending messages in different directions. Maybe sometimes the language or the choice of particular terminology might not be helpful and might take the statement in a different direction at odds with the content of the statement. This happens from time to time. However, these statements shouldn't be taken out of context. The Russian view of the relationship with Iran is a strategic one. As for Syria, the Russians do not interfere in Syrian affairs. If they have a certain opinion, they raise it with us and say that. In the end, the decision is that of the Syrian leadership and the Syrian people. This is a constant principle for Russia. Therefore, the alliance is a strategic one. And if there are differences, such differences happen within the Syrian state. And you see differences within the Iranian state and within the Russian state. It is natural for us to differ on daily tactical details. For why conduct a dialogue if we agree on everything? We meet extensively in order to reach agreement.
So this tripartite alliance is being consolidated?
Of course. This is dictated by reality, interest, and international changes that make it necessary for this alliance to be consolidated. As long as the other axis supports terrorism, and as long as we, together with Iran and Russia, feel the danger of terrorism, not only in Syria but also on all these countries and on the whole world, and as long as Syria, Iran, and Russia realize the importance of abiding by international law, these facts make the existence of this alliance necessary.
But there are those who say that Syria will get a price if the Iranians leave Syrian territories. Is there a certain political, moral, or military price in this regard?
As I said in the beginning, as long as this relationship is not floated in the bazaar, they cannot offer a price, and the answer will be clear. That's why they don't dare suggest this price. This issue was raised by different countries, including Saudi Arabia, for instance, at the beginning of the war. And not only at the beginning, but at different stages. The proposition was that if Syria cut its relationship with Iran, the situation in Syria will be normal. This principle is basically rejected by us.
So there were initiatives, so to speak, made in this regard by Saudi Arabia.
During the war?
Yes.
Of course, more than once, and in a clear manner.
Directly?
Directly. The relationship with Iran was the basis for every proposition. And Saudi Arabia's position on this subject is public. I am not revealing a secret.
An issue has been raised in Syria, Iran, or Lebanon about the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria. Some call them Iranian advisors. Even the Syrian foreign minister used the same term. At the same time, we notice that there are Iranian martyrs. Frankly, Mr. President, what is the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria now?
The term advisor is sometimes used in a broad manner. These advisors have been with us through the long-standing relationship with Iran, even before the war, because the military relationship is close. When a military formation moves to a fighting position, the advisor becomes a fighter. So, the word can be used in different senses. There are certainly Iranian advisors in Syria, and there are groups of Iranian volunteers who came to Syria, and they are led by Iranian officers. Iran has fought with and defended the Syrian people. It offered blood. That's why when we say advisors, this is a generic term. But this doesn't mean that we are ashamed of any Iranian presence, even if it is official. But we use the word advisors because there are no regular Iranian fighting units in Syria.
Full formations.
Exactly. There are no battalions or brigades or divisions. First, we can't hide them. And then, why should we be ashamed of that? When we invited the Russians legally to come to Syria, we were not ashamed of that. And if there were an Iranian formation, we would announce it. Because such relations need agreements between the two states endorsed by parliaments. Such relations cannot be concealed.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
Of course. From the beginning, we invited the Iranians, and then we invited the Russians. We needed the support of these countries, and they answered the call.
Mr. President, you said more than once that there are no Iranian bases in Syria.
That's correct.
So how come there are no Iranian bases while we notice that there are a number of Russian ones?
There is nothing that prevents the existence of such bases, as long as Iran is an ally, as is Russia. If we ask, we will ask them to agree. I mean, that we could ask for the existence of such forces to support us. Iran has never asked and does not have an interest except in fighting terrorism. But the evolution of the war made it necessary to develop the nature of this presence. This happened as far as the Russians are concerned. In the beginning, Russian support, like Iranian support, was different from what it is today. The support for terrorism has developed internationally and globally when the Syrian army confronted those terrorists. And with that, Russian and Iranian military presence developed. At a certain stage, we found, with the Russians of course, that the existence of air bases was necessary to provide air support to the Syrian army. And now, if we find, in cooperation, coordination, or dialogue with the Iranians, that there is a need for Iranian military bases, we will not hesitate. But now, Iranian support in its present form is good and effective.
Why haven't you visited Iran so far, although you visited Russia more than once?
That's correct. In fact, there was a scheduled visit to Iran a few months ago, and it was postponed and not cancelled. It was postponed because of an emergency in Syria related to the development of battles. There is certainly no reason which prevents such a visit, and I'll visit Iran hopefully soon on the earliest opportunity. This is natural, but the issue is logistic, no more, no less.
Mr. President, I move to another file. Last week, it was the Jerusalem International Day, and the Palestinian cause is going through its most difficult stages. We are talking about the deal of the century and moving the American embassy to occupy Jerusalem. What do you have to say about Palestine? Is Syria still capable of supporting the Palestine cause? Basically, wasn't one of the most important objectives of the war on Syria to get Syria out of the axis of resistance and to prevent it from supporting resistance, whether in Lebanon or Palestine?
The Palestine context, since 1948 up till now, has been a complicated one because the regional context is complicated. Of course, it is complicated because the colonial West, which is particularly supportive of Israel, has always created elements which aim at one single thing. First, to drive to desperation the Arab citizen, who is historically attached to the cause of Palestine and who has always considered it a pan-Arab cause that touched him even on the national level. The other objective has been to distract the Arab peoples together with states or societies in general to marginal causes so that they do not have time to think about Israel. And they have succeeded to a great extent, most recently through the so-called Arab Spring, which has aimed at destroying the political, military, and psychological infrastructure of Arab societies. Nevertheless, recent developments have proven that the Arab people is still conscientiously attached to the cause of Palestine. As for Syria, since it has been part of these plots to undermine the Arab condition in general, first, for Syria to support the cause of Palestine, it should first of all destroy the Israeli army in Syria. Restoring stability in Syria, striking terrorism, and foiling the Israeli plot in Syria is certainly part of supporting the cause of Palestine. The support might be indirect with direct consequences, but these direct consequences are linked to the internal Palestinian condition. We shouldn't forget that the Palestinians are divided between groups which resist Israel and are genuinely linked to the cause of Palestine, and other groups which are against the resistance and support surrenderist and defeatist peace, while there are other groups which use resistance as a title in order to achieve their political objectives under the slogan of religion. This is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's approach.
Are you prepared to offer whatever the resistance asks of you, whether in the form of political, military, or any other form of support?
Politically, we haven't changed. The Palestinian question for us is still as it was 10 years ago and decades ago. It hasn't changed. As to what we can offer, this has to do with two things. First, Syria's current capabilities, and there is no doubt that the priority is given now to cleaning Syria of terrorism. Second, it has to do with the Palestinian condition and the parties with which we can deal within the Palestinian arena.
Since we are talking about resistance, there's the other side. In addition to some countries which stood beside Syria in fighting terrorism, there was also a role played by the resistance in Lebanon, particularly Hezbollah, which provided a great deal and contributed to fighting terrorism. What do you say, Mr. President, to resistance fighters and families of martyrs and the wounded?
When all these groups of resistance get together to defend Syrian soil and Syrian citizens, including the Lebanese resistance and the brothers who came from Iraq, some of whom reproached me for not mentioning them by name, I take this opportunity to stress that there are brothers from Iraq to whom we give the same weight of any resistance fighter who came from any other country. There are also the families of resistance fighters who came from Iran and sacrificed their blood in Syria. We should put all these in the same basket next to the Syrian martyrs, fighters, and their families. To those I say that all the letters, the words, the sentences, and the whole of literature are much less than a single drop of blood. Therefore, words are of a much lesser value than what they have offered. What's more important is what history will write about them. In fact, when we talk about writing history, we need to highlight that history needs a strategy and needs X. But the fact remains that strategy without implementation on the ground has no value. It remains mere thought, which we might include in books and essays. But the reality is that these individuals in these countries, this group of resistance fighters, not politics, write history. I would like to use the answer to this question to express to them all my love, respect, and appreciation, and my reverence to the fighters, the wounded, and martyrs, and to all their families who are courage incarnated and who send these individuals to Syria to defend it and fight terrorism, so that these families become models of morality and principles for present and future generations.
Have you asked Hezbollah to leave Syria? A few days ago, His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about this issue and said that nobody can get us out of Syria unless the Syrian leadership asks us to do so.
The battle is long and ongoing. When we talk about this tripartite alliance, and if we consider it a quadruple alliance when we add Hezbollah, we talk about the tripartite alliance in terms of the states included. But in the end, Hezbollah is a basic element in this war. The battle is long, and the need for these military forces will continue for a long time. When there is a need, and when Hezbollah, Iran, or others believe that terrorism has been eliminated, they will tell us that they want to go home. As Sayyid Hassan said, they have families and daily interests, which is normal, but it is still early to talk about this subject.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's been rather trendy over the past few years to talk about the new world order. Fair enough. But what we're experiencing now is the end of the old world order. The recent G7 confab in Canada and Trump's decision to engage North Korea are just two examples. Pax Americana is undergoing a significant transformation, and the old order is fighting back tooth and nail. Crosstalking the old world order, I'm joined by my guest, John Merrill in Washington. He is the former chief of the Northeast Asia Division of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the U.S. State Department, as well as author of Korea, The Peninsular Origins of the War. Also in Washington, we have Michael Flanagan. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. And in New York, we cross to George Samueli. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London and author of the book Bombs for Peace. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first here. I think it's pretty fair to say after 500 some days in office, we're beginning to see what an American first foreign policy is under Donald Trump. So my question to you is, America first under Trump, compatible with the post-World War II liberal order that the United States heralded into being. And is 2018 a significant date for that order that appears to be, well, changing, if not breaking down? Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I think that the American foreign policy, your question presupposes that we've been the same since the Second World War. And I think while we've had very likely goals from administration to administration that are very similar, I don't think we've had the same execution of that foreign policy. And I think you're seeing a very different execution of the foreign policy, one that's more trade-centric, one that's less interested in making a macro once-over-the-world, got-to-embrace-everything deal, but taking deals a bit at a time, much as a businessman would. And I think you're seeing a level of foreign policy interaction and product that is unfamiliar to many in the structures now, but is in no way bad. And I think that that's giving a lot of pause to professionals who have been doing this for years, and excellently for years, but different doesn't necessarily mean wrong. And I think we're moving in the right direction.
I'm not judging if it's right or wrong. I'm describing it because I don't know if it's right or wrong yet. Okay. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because I'm not talking about the New World Order because I don't know what that is. Okay. But I do know what we've had for the last 70 odd years. Yeah. Okay. Let me give more or less the same question to John, because Michael gave it kind of from an American point of view, but there's a lot of American allies around the world see it very, very differently than the current occupant in the White House. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think the Asian allies are coming along. He's right. Trump's foreign policy approach is different than his predecessors. It's more realistic, more hard-nosed, and even a little more improvisational. I think there's a tendency towards neo-isolationism. And there are doubts about alliances, particularly when there is a perceived asymmetry of burdens and interests.
Yep.
So I think that he also feels the traditional alliance management emphasis that we've had has fostered excessive dependency and created moral hazards. So he's trying to solve, in my opinion, trying to solve some problems, and he's a disruptor.
Okay, George, your turn. I mean,
and I think you see that with Korea.
Okay, I think you can see it in a lot of different things right now. In this sense, I think these tendencies towards isolationism are overblown. I think John really mentioned it. I mean, a lot of people have benefited from American largesse, particularly in trade and security. I mean, you know, the United States is willing to guarantee the security of Europe's borders, but not its own country. I mean, you know, when is this going to stop? Enough is enough. Go ahead, George.
Yes, but that's always been the key to America's overwhelming presence in the world. It's been the leader of this massive bloc, this massive NATO European Union bloc. And that's given it, America this huge influence. Now, America had to pay a price for that. And the price it paid was that it was running massive trade deficits with everybody. Because, you know, in return for their not contributing very much to military spending, America gave them privileged access to U.S. markets. It didn't matter very much because as long as the dollar was the world's reserve currency, the trade deficits would eventually all go back to America anyway into finance. But now Trump has said that American economic supremacy is under challenge. And with the rise of China and the China-Russia bloc, that is a real serious challenge to the United States. So he's now trying to shake this up. He's saying, okay, now this bloc that we're leaders of, they really have to jump to it. They have to follow our goals. What we want, whether it's in the Middle East or anywhere else, they will have to follow. Where in the past they say, okay, well, yes, we have our foibles such as Israel, and you don't really agree with it, but it doesn't matter. We'll overlook it. Now the Trump doctrine is that you have to really follow it, because if you don't follow us, then you will pay a price. And so we see this with in the case of Iran. America has not just walked away from the JCPOA. It's actually imposing penalties on the Europeans who are actually sticking with the agreement. And so that's what really Trump said. Trump is trying to consolidate this bloc in order to confront at some later date the new colossus emerging in the world, which is China, in alliance with Russia.
Okay, you know, Michael, I tend to agree with George there, but the issue is that it's not really a bloc of even remotely equals. It's one country calling the shots. If you don't follow in line, you will be sanctioned like the U.S. has sanctioned its quote-unquote adversaries and foes. I mean, that is kind of a upping the game of sanctions, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, we're America, bitch. I mean, that's kind of what the administration has been talking about with the America First policy. Forgive my use of the vulgar. The administration really is not driven ideologically to have a one world borderless society as perhaps the Obama administration was leaning toward, and is not looking to have a Pax Americana as the neocons and the Bush administration were looking for. I think it's looking for global leadership in the finance sector, in the trade sector. And I think Trump is absolutely focused in that direction, and where there is some big line crossed, like chemical weapons or the belief of use of chemical weapons, to step away from that argument here, or to be able to talk about some really egregious behavior by a world actor, the administration is going to shrug and move past that,
yeah,
and say we have bigger fish to fry,
you know,
with
Michael,
more important players like China, like Russia, and elsewhere.
But Michael, you know, Trump's critics, particularly in the liberal media, saying, you know, Trump wants to move away from a rules-based international order. Well, I mean, if I take what you say logically speaking, then the United States doesn't give a hoot about the United Nations. It's going to unilaterally bomb whatever country it wants. It will impose sanctions on any country it wants. I mean, it'll walk away from the WTO, the United Nations. I mean, that's the extreme. Okay, that's where this is going to, and that's why I'm not talking about the new world order, because I don't know what it's going to be. John, go ahead and jump in. I noticed you were reacting.
Well, I think that's a little extreme way to put it. What we've seen Trump do in the case of Korea is settle a long festering problem and break with traditional prescriptions.
Good.
And being willing to sit down and have a dialogue with the leader of North Korea. I'm calling him the leader of North Korea because one of the things that American media do all the time,
yep,
is they call him a dictator or a tyrant. Anyway, he's having a conversation, and he's trying to bring to bear, I hope he's successful. He
Me
seems
too.
To have had some success so far. He's trying to establish a degree of rapport and to schmooze the guy, and hoping that will bring him along and will be able to make progress. So let's see how that plays out. I think so far he's been doing a pretty good job on the Korean issue. Even some Democrats are beginning to realize that, although belatedly.
Well, George, I am 100% behind Donald Trump's engagement of North Korea. Absolutely. If that's what it takes for peace, then I'm on board, okay? And I just hope that it's not sabotaged by his own people around him. I worry more about who's around in the Oval Office than who was in Singapore. George.
Yes. No, that's exactly so. I don't think anyone is going to sabotage the North Korea deal within the administration, simply because North Korea has now become Trump's baby.
Yeah, it's his.
He's very much preoccupied with this. You know, this is going to be his Reagan and Gorbachev moment. You know, he wants this as his historic moment, that he's going to do something that no one else has done. But you have to balance that with his policy on Iran, because on Iran, he is far more belligerent than his predecessors were, and he seems to be moving towards a very serious confrontation there. I mean, he has said a few more conciliatory things about Iran in recent days, but I don't think it's very likely that there'll be any change there. And similarly, I think in the case of Syria, I think we can expect more belligerence from the United States there. So while, yes, he's doing a good job on Korea, when it comes to the Middle East, I think he's being more belligerent than his predecessors.
You know, Michael, is it because Trump doesn't really care about the Middle East? He thinks let the Israelis and the Saudis figure it out for him, because North Korea, that's his Nobel Prize. That's him. That's all about him. He's taken this. He's taken on board. I mean, it seems you could interpret it that way, because, I mean, his behavior in the Middle East is, in my opinion, just disastrous. Go ahead, Michael, before we go to the break.
Yeah, I don't, you and I have disagreed on this before, Peter, but smart people can do that.
Sure.
I think his embracing of the Arabs against the Persians, if you can go back to the ancient descriptions, is trying to move the geopolitical center of the Middle East back to the Arab side, away from its hungry and formerly aggressive neighbors. And I think the difference between Korea and Iran, very quickly, is because Iran exports its pain. Korea internalizes most of its pain, except for an occasional threat to blow somebody up. And so I think that you can take Korea and Iran in very different sips. But both of them are being dealt with fairly aggressively by this administration. And I think successfully thus far.
Well, we haven't come any closer in our disagreements on that. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the old world order. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to John in Washington. I think one thing that is clear that I don't think there's really much disagreement about is that Donald Trump seems to be almost obsessed with undoing Obama's legacy, okay? I'm just putting that out there, okay? So John, I mean, if Trump is juxtaposing his foreign policy to his predecessor, what are the confines then? You've already mentioned that it's more realistic. I would agree with that, okay? But what does Trump want to achieve in his first 4 years in office? Because presumably he wants to be there for eight. What's Trump world look like, let's say, after 8 years? Go ahead, John.
Well, I think we've already covered some of that. But he wants to distance himself from his predecessors and to make his own mark, not just distance from Obama, but even recent Republican presidents. So I think Trump is much more numerate. He is able to tally up costs and benefits, maybe a tendency to look at things in zero sum terms. And he relies much more on feel, on charisma, perceived deal-making ability. And so he's prepared to strike off on new directions. And in the case of the Korean problem, I think this is long overdue. The policy of strategic patience, I think, was an abysmal failure. And I'm actually surprised that some of the people who were behind this policy are showing up now and criticizing Trump's initiative. So I think he's done a great job on Korea, and let's hope he can pull it off. Now, there was reluctance among the Japanese, but I think they've accommodated themselves to that. Prime Minister Abe's policy is beginning to shift in the direction of Trump. And of course, in South Korea, he has a progressive president who is very supportive of what he's trying to do. So who knows? Maybe we'll get progress on the Korean issue, which is the most pressing security issue in the world right now, I would argue.
Okay, George, John just mentioned charisma. I mean, I remember my Max Weber very well. You know, I thought charisma died in modernity. I think this is one of the interesting things. I think it's fascinating. No, it's a fascinating point, because that's why the rest of the world doesn't understand him. They don't understand him because he is a charismatic figure, because the Europeans in their postmodernist mind couldn't see charisma if it hit him in the face. Go ahead, George.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right about the Max Weber, because it was after it was John F. Kennedy that there was reintroduced that term charisma, and suddenly, you know, people were thinking back on the Max Weber term. So I think that's right, that he is somebody who is the charismatic figure, and he's and he does want to shake things up. But you've got to also look at the other side. He is consolidating the Russia-China bloc. And really, you know, he had campaigned, essentially, though he hadn't said it explicitly, to break up that Russia-China bloc. Whether that's feasible or not, that's a different matter. But he wanted to break that up, because, you know, he I think has a sort of that Nixonian realism about him, which is that this is a bad thing for America when Russia and China are close together. So what he's now doing is pushing the two of them together. And he's done nothing in order to improve relations with Russia, and everything that he's doing now, particularly when he's actually hitting the Europeans for having the temerity to get their gas cheaper from Russia than from America, that's only going to consolidate
the horror of it.
an even bigger anti-American bloc.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. The horror of it. They want to get a better deal. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Michael, I'm glad George brought that up. I'm glad George brought that up because I you may know more about this than I do, but my sense is that Steve Bannon was kind of an influence on Trump that way, is that, you know, the U.S. And Russia shouldn't be enemies. Maybe they won't be great friends, but they shouldn't be enemies. But believing that they could pull Russia and China apart in 2018, I think, is kind of naive now. That train has left the station. It's not going to go back. We have to remind our viewers, because Western media won't do it. Who was meeting during the G7 halfway around the world? The Chinese and the Russians, okay, at the same time. I lament that very much. I think this whole ridiculous Russiagate thing has derailed relations, maybe for a generation. And I find it lamentable, and John can speak to this. I mean, how the mainstream media and the Democrats have just gone into Trump for this North Korean thing. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But my God, history's going to remember that he tried. He's not going to have a chance to try with Russia. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that I agree with George completely. I don't know if Trump is bent on separating China and Russia as much as he's bent on joining them together, perhaps. Our interests in North Korea are virtually identical, and I think that was the reason for the China-Russia meeting at the same time while the Singapore meeting was going on. Much of the same discussion was going on in that meeting, and the Chinese had very successful and conciliatory moves to help Trump with his policies with regard to their deployment of military forces. Trump has recently asked for Russia to be re-entered to the G7, making it the G8 or the G8+1 or whatever it is. And is regularly saying laudatory things about Chairman He, although they struggle over trade and other issues. I think there is an understanding that by the Trump administration that there's some interest in having equal trade partners. And if you always think of Trump in the focus of trade and trade deals, his conciliation or his bluster, as it may be, from one day to the next about these guys is about making the deal more than about having permanent relations or permanent enemies.
That's a very fair point. You know, John, one of the things, see, this is where the when I started out with America First and the liberal order. See, Michael just hit the nail on the head. I mean, this administration is very focused on the balance sheet. What do we get out of it? See, but America's allies, either they've enveloped it or absorbed it, or I don't know. They think in terms of values all the time, Western values all the time. And they're not practiced very well. The European Union is not particularly democratic, okay? That's why I have a lot of these populist movements coming up. The fact that Trump was elected also talks about how people feel about the country. I mean, we had the Democratic primary rigged. I mean, you know, democracy and all these other things people talk about, it's a lot of it is just hypocrisy. And that's why Trump, if you agree with or disagree with him, in a way is kind of a breath of fresh air, because you know where you stand all the time. Go ahead, John.
I think the main problem with the mainstream U.S. approach to foreign policy is the absence of self-reflection.
I agree.
Let me give you a quick example. Everyone's talking about the North Korean gulag, and oh my God, they have so many people in jail. No one ever thinks to look at the comparative dimension of this. There is almost 1% of the U.S. population is incarcerated. It's the highest rate in the world. Now, they stick around for a long time. They don't die off. So I suppose you could say that in defense of U.S. prison policy. But we're very quick to condemn other countries and never really self-reflect about what is the matter in our system. So I think that I give Trump credit. I'm reluctant to say this too much because I was brought up as a Democrat. I've been a registered Democrat all my life. But this is a kind of crossover leader. And I think he is attracting, as maybe it was George that said this, he's attracting crossover voters. So let's see what happens. If he makes a go of Korea, I think he's got a second term.
Okay.
I think it's that simple.
Well, I think it's still going to be the economy. But if he can go on the campaign trail walking around with that medal, that Nobel Prize medal, maybe that'll impress some people here. I know some of his base is interested in that. You know, George, I'm really glad that, you know, we're talking about this dimension of it because, you know, North Korea's gulags and all that. I mean, what about beheading and stoning of people in Saudi Arabia? I mean, that doesn't really make any news in the United States. I mean, if you're an expert in the field, you'll know about that. It never makes the mainstream news. I mean, virtual genocide is being committed in Yemen, and Western countries are involved in that. That never is ever mentioned. But, you know, that's not to dismiss human rights violations in North Korea. But this is what the liberals and the media always do. They always attach these other things on. That's why I am a proponent of the Iran deal. It was about one thing and one thing only, and it could have been a demonstration effect for other things later. Unfortunately, that's where I disagree with the current president. Go ahead, George.
Yes. That's exactly so. So whenever American talking heads and policymakers, pundits come along and say, well, we Americans, we really care so much about values, they only ever care about values about certain countries, the countries that are regarded as adversaries of the United States. So suddenly we really, really care about human rights in North Korea. Couldn't care less about human rights in Saudi Arabia, human rights in Yemen. I mean, Israel can kill any number of people. It can in Gaza, and Nikki Haley would just shrug her shoulders and say it was all the fault of Hamas and Iran. So, you know, human rights is only ever brought up as another cudgel to beat the perceived adversaries of the United States. And so while Trump is refreshingly free of all this cant about human rights, he nonetheless still comes up with this nonsense when it comes to talking about Iran. And of course, Peter, you remember what he talks about Syria. You remember all those the beautiful babies and all those terrible, you know, that Assad is an animal murdering beautiful little babies. So he's also not free from this kind of emotional, moralistic rhetoric. But at least on Korea, he has been refreshingly free of that.
All right, let me go to Michael. Last word, you're a Trump supporter. Last 30 seconds go to you, my friend.
I agree and I disagree with George. I think Trump, in finding his feet in the White House, had a lot of influence on him. And I think a lot of it was good and a lot of it was bad. And I think as he progresses, he's going to be less talking about the beautiful babies, although I also cringed when you said that, because you're right. But I think you're going to have more real politic talk about real interactions with real countries as opposed to the emotional.
Okay.
We're affected by beautiful babies here, but not there.
It's official on this program. The New World Order started. Thank you, gentlemen. We've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York. Thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.